are listening to the INCJ podcast, Conversations about International Criminal Justice.
Welcome, everybody. My name is Roz Morrison, and it's my job today to chair the webinar. So thank you for joining in this INCJ event. So our subject today is international perspectives on the role of punishment. And we hope that we have an interesting and lively conversation today. So how the webinar is going to work is that I'm going to ask Rob to have a short introduction, followed by a response from Martine, and then followed by a roundtable discussion with our international contributors. So we want our audience to put points and questions to the roundtable. So please use the chat function on Zoom, and I'll try to do my best to put comments or issues forward to the roundtable to consider later. So what I'm going to do now is just ask everyone to just briefly introduce themselves, as we said, your role, your name, and then afterwards I'll ask Rob to begin his introductory presentation. So can I start with you, Selda, to introduce yourself, please? Thank you.
Thanks, Roz. I'm Selda Dagestanley. I am an Australian academic and I'm currently based in New York. I work in a criminology department and I'm also working as an adjunct as a criminology academic over here at Hunter College. I'm from Western Sydney University. I teach into prisons and punishment, and my research expertise explores punishment as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Michael?
Yes, thank you. Hello, everyone. I'm Michael Nail. I serve as commissioner for the Georgia Department of Community Supervision here in the United States. We're responsible for all felony adults that are supervised either on parole or probation. We actually lead the nation, unfortunately, in the number that are under our supervision.
Sorry, Michael, I'm not sure what happened there. I think somebody joined and they had their microphone on. So
that's okay. I think I was just leaving with the fact that we supervise just over 200,000, which is the largest in the nation, unfortunately. So it's rather challenging in that regard.
Brilliant. About 200,000. Wow. That is a huge challenge. Thank you. Martine, would you like to briefly introduce yourself?
Yes, thank you. So I'm very happy to be here. So I am Martine. I teach at the University of Reims in France. You're all going to have to pronounce it. That's my usual joke. Reims, repeat after me. Jokes aside, I specialized in prisons and probation. Essentially a researcher, but I've got a background as well in what else have I done? Addiction treatment in the early 90s, when it was the methadone and needle exchange programs that were kicking in. I've been a disciplinary accessory at the local jail, worked in a law firm, done a lot of practical stuff apart from research. But I'm essentially a researcher now and a teacher.
Thank you. Thank you, Martine. And we are expecting John Sturgeon from west of Scotland to join us in a few minutes. And is John there? Ah.
Yeah.
Hi, John. I couldn't see you. I just saw your name popped up.
Yeah. Hello, Roz.
Hi.
My name is John Sturgeon, and I'm in the town of Dumfries in the southwest of Scotland, where today the hill that was here yesterday has just disappeared. We're having a misty day here. I'm a lecturer in social work at the University of the West of Scotland down here in Dumfries. I've been doing that for 13 years. Before that, I was a criminal justice social worker working in the Scottish probation system, part of the local social services, and I was also a service manager latterly. My kind of research interests are in rural social work practice, and also I've been involved in doing some research into probation practice in Scotland and also in France as well. So I've been to Orans, where I have met Martine on a couple of occasions.
Thank you, John. We can't see you. So I didn't know if that was...
I can see myself.
Okay.
I'll try and sort it out.
Thank you. Okay, thank you for your introductions. And now I'm going to pass over to Rob Canton, our Professor Emeritus from the De Montfort University in the UK, to open the webinar with his introductory thoughts.
Thank you so much, Ros. I'll just say, introduce myself briefly, if I may. As Ros has said, I'm a Professor Emeritus, and those of you who are Latin scholars will know that this word comes from two Latin words, a meaning out of it, and meritus meaning deservedly so. I retired last year after a career that in probation for 20 years plus, and then moving into a university for another 20 years or so. So one way or another, a great deal of my professional career has been concerned and preoccupied with concerns about punishment. And in the last few years, I've tried to understand this better and tried to explore my thinking in a couple of books. And if health and imagination and creativity allow, I'm planning to write another, but that's some way down the line. It's something of a luxury, isn't it? You know, to reflect in this way. We those of us who've worked in criminal justice or scholarship, we get up in the mornings, we go off to work, we do our job, we fill in forms, we talk to one another, we plan strategies, we engage with service users, all kinds of things. But why are we doing any of this? What the meaning of it and the broader significance? These are questions that aren't always easy to frame. But that's the sort of thing I've tried to ask myself about in recent years, and to consider not only the what shapes practice, the social science dimensions, if you like, but also the philosophy of punishment. Why do we do these things? What is the justification for doing these things? Because on the face of it, some of the things that human beings have done to others in different times and places are quite dreadful. And we think that we wouldn't countenance people treating each other in that way at all. But we think it's all right if it's done in the name of punishment. So what is the justification? Can we get away with that? Now, social scientists are often concerned with the differences between different countries in the levels of punishment. And you'll all be familiar with these tables, won't you, that set out the prison populations in different countries and the extremes that they can go to. There are marked differences in jurisdictions. So why might that be? We also could, but I don't think we will much today, talk about changes in the types of punishment. Why is it that punishments, sometime at the moment, the prison is among the first types of punishment that people think about when they consider the topic at all. But why do some of these things come into vogue and then they go away again? There's a huge literature that tries to understand why those developments take place. If we look at levels of punishment, a very famous analysis led by Michael Cavadino and James Dignan tried to identify countries and put them into categories, and they tried to make explicit connections between socioeconomic systems and levels of punishment. Maybe there are, for example, links between punitiveness and a welfare state. Countries that have a strong welfare state may recognize a duty that we owe to one another in a mutually supportive society. A strong sense of social solidarity, a recognition of the vulnerability that we all share and the constraints that limit choices to a point where people feel they have no option but to commit crimes. Perhaps that leads to a diminished sense of, it's just a cat wandering across my keyboard. Do you mind? I'm so sorry about that. I warned you earlier, it's wet out there and the cat's decided he's not going out anyway. By contrast, there'll be other countries where people are expected to stand on their own two feet, as it were. There's a strong sense of individualism. The welfare state may be accordingly diminished, and it may be that those countries are more punitive than others. So that kind of theorizing can be quite suggestive and instructive, but still all sorts of problems remain. For example, you might think that Canada and the United States of America have very similar socioeconomic arrangements, all kinds of things in common. And yet Canada's prison population is 104 per 100,000. The United States, on average, 629. So something like six times the size of the prison population. Why might that be? And indeed, Cavadino and Dignan at the end throw their hands up in despair and put their conclusion very well. They say, however many factors we incorporate into our theory, it will still not give us the whole story. Individual nations and their cultures, histories, and politics can be just as quirky and esoteric as individual human beings. But even if we could make these really strong connections between the social economic order and practice, there's a missing bridge, isn't there? How do those things work their way down? How does the economic order actually exercise its influence on the thinking and practices of different jurisdictions? Because when probation staff do what they do, and when judges and courts do what they do, and prison officers and so on, they don't not thinking in terms of the economic order. And Marxist scholarship would say, well, the bridge between these two things is ideology. And it's the thoughts and feelings that find expression in our discussions and our policies, our institutions and practices. These are ideological, and they can ultimately be grounded in social economy. There are lots of other things besides. There's technology, and increasingly commerce shapes the character of penal practice, doesn't it? But there's also, I think, and I'd be interested to hear, I'd like to say a bit more about this, if I may, but also to hear your views. There are aspects of culture, which I don't think are reducible simply to the socioeconomic order. So Sonia Schnacken has noted that the tendencies that we sometimes present as universal, which, for example, the British concept of the new punitiveness and David Garland's expression of the culture of control, these set out to be universal accounts, but in fact are Anglo-American. And one of the things that I hope that we'll get out of this discussion this afternoon is some sense of other perspectives, other countries. Do we all see these things in the same way? I think much less investigation has taken place into what people understand themselves to be doing when they're involved in the practices of punishment. And punishment has probably always and everywhere been a response to wrongdoing, but the reasons why we do this, how we should go about determining a fitting punishment are complex. Now, in English law, there are a set of purposes that courts are supposed to take into account when they determine sentence. And I'm just going to run through them briefly. The first is the punishment of offenders, by which I think essentially is meant the idea of desert. People should be, people simply deserve to be punished. The next set are reductive, if you like. They aim at the reduction of crime. One of them explicitly says the reduction of crime, including by deterrence. The next, reform and rehabilitation, public protection. And then there's this final one of making of reparation, which might open up questions of restorative justice. And there's a debate, isn't there, within the restorative justice community itself, whether restorative justice is a type of punishment or whether it is something other than punishment. Now, whether the criminal justice system is the best way of achieving any of these purposes, or even whether it could achieve them at all, is a topic maybe for another seminar. But my interest today is whether there are other countries who have different expectations of what sentencing might achieve, and how those expectations might have their impact upon institutions and practices. There's an excellent book that was published a few years ago by an American scholar named Philip Smith, who looked at the way in which punishment changes and the forms of punishment change. And his argument is that it changes not when they fail to achieve the objectives set for them, But when they no longer are accepted by courts or by the public as suitable punishments, that's the catalyst of change. So in my country, and I think in a number of other jurisdictions, there's been a lot of emphasis on what works, what can be shown to be effective. And Smith would say, by and large, that is never the reason why punishments change. And lots of punishments are known to fail, but they don't give way for that reason. They give way because they don't look like punishment. And I'm aware that among our number today is Mike Nellis, who knows more than anybody else I know about electronic monitoring. Now, how that is, whether or not that can become acceptable, whether the general community regard that as punishment, I think there's a wide range of differences about that. But Philip Smith would say that unless a form of punishment can establish itself as acceptable and meaningful punishment, then it's not going to prosper. So where do our attitudes come from? How do we make judgments about what is acceptable? And Smith leans heavily on this idea of he calls culture, cultures that reflect and reproduce attitudes that lead us to make judgments of this kind. And increasingly, I would want to add in the significance of emotion. And if anyone wants to talk more about that, I'd be interested to hear their views as well. Our attitudes are produced, reproduced, and reflected in literature, in films, in all kinds of media, and perhaps most saliently and obviously in holy texts, in myths, in legends, and in stories. And this may be a simple example, but I think it's quite an instructive one. The distinguished Australian criminologist, John Braithwaite, once wrote about the Japanese version of the story of Little Red Riding Hood. Now, Little Red Riding Hood, in the version that I grew up with, the wolf eats up grandma. Little Red Riding Hood, the wolf eats up grandma. The hunters come along, they slay the wolf, cut open the wolf, and grandma is released. But in the Japanese version, according to John Braithwaite, when the hunters arrive and confront the wolf is filled with shame and remorse, falls to his knees and weeps and promises to mend his ways, and forgiveness is duly granted. Now, what happened to Grandma, I'm afraid, is not apparent in that particular story, and that might be worth pondering as well. Do some modes of punishment lose sight of the victim? But nevertheless, I think that story could be quite eloquent about different kinds of culture, about what we think of as a proper response to wrongdoing, about how much weight should be given to factors like remorse and forgiveness. And as we grow up with those stories, we perhaps are offered a way of thinking and feeling about these matters, which forms a backdrop against which our views about punishment in later life come to be appraised. This is not only of theoretical interest, but I think it's of practical importance for consider the possibilities of policy transfer. So learning lessons and taking practices from one country to another. Sometimes culture seems to support these efforts. Baroness Vivian Stern once wrote about how she introduced community service, unpaid work, to Zimbabwe. And she was told that it's the restorative aspect of community service was absolutely in harmony with African traditions of reparation and reconciliation with Ubuntu. Those traditions having been suppressed by the retributive preoccupations of European colonizers, especially from Britain. But there may be occasions when the innovation fails to prosper. A mode of punishment might be introduced, which for whatever reason is rejected, but most prominently it's rejected because it doesn't look like proper punishment against the background of the cultural assumptions and expectations of that nation. And I think that probation supervision can be particularly difficult to introduce on that basis. I've tried to promote probation in a number of countries, but I think in at least some places, it just seems too elusive, even in countries where cultural assumptions are shared. Heaven knows it's difficult enough to explain the concept to people in our own countries who understand it. Plenty of people in this country would readily admit they don't know much about probation, but they don't think much of it either. They don't have confidence in it. It seems not to be a proper punishment. Is it because they don't believe that people are able to change? That may be one possibility. How, even if they do believe that people can change, how widespread is the view that this can be accomplished by the methods of probation that are familiar to us? So if forms of punishment are to be accepted, they must be in harmony with how people are expected to be. And conceptions of, if you think that people, some people are ineradicably bad people, that's going to work against arguments in favor of probation. There are also circumstances, of course, where power dynamics distort and corrupt a policy transfer. In one European nation I worked in, no community service orders had ever been made, despite legal provision. And then a powerful local politician came to court to answer corruption charges. And at that point, rather than sending him to prison, the judges instructed him to undertake community service, which met, of course, understandable cynicism and disdain from ordinary folk who knew that their own fate would have been imprisonment. Another disheartening example comes from Australia. At least partly under the influence of Braithwaite, indigenous practices of restorative conferencing were introduced, but some years later, someone wryly reflected that conferencing was now the preferred process for middle-class white youngsters, while Aboriginal folk were still much more likely to be sent to prison. And I think these reflections have a direct bearing on the work of the INCJ. When we exchange ideas, are we sometimes doing so against the background of different assumptions and meanings, whether our own assumptions or those of other people in respective countries? And if I'm right in thinking that culture and emotion have an independent weight, no less than socioeconomic factors, we must recognize that there are argumentation will have its limits. In short, we need to change hearts as well as minds if we're going to introduce penal reform. That's me for now. Thank you ever so much for listening to me. I promised Roz that I wouldn't take much more than 15 minutes, and I only took a little bit more. So I'm going to switch off my microphone and pass back to you, Roz.
Oh, thank you so much, Rob. As always, a really, really interesting and thought-provoking introduction. And now to respond to Rob's introduction, I'd ask Martine to, as our next contributor, to respond to Rob. Thank you.
Thank you, Roz. Thank you, Rob. And thanks everybody. It's really a fascinating talk. So I'm not going to structure much what I'm going to say. They're just really reactions to everything Rob has said. So the first point you raised was the potential link between levels of punitiveness and the state of the welfare system. And I was obviously considering what has happened in France over the last years. We used to have quite a generous welfare system, not as generous as in England, but quite generous nonetheless. And as has been the case in the UK, fundings have dwindled with various policies that we've had. And I don't know if it's proof in the pudding, but incarceration rates have gone up. Not dramatically so, mind you. It was below 100, but now it's 119. I've checked right before the meeting, the discussion, and it's going up. And not only is it going up, but the length of time people spend in prison, whilst probably ridiculous compared to the United States, I hasten to say, but it used to be in the 1980s around 4 months. And it's now 10. So it's more than doubled. So that is showing something. Whether it's caused by the differences in the welfare system, obviously, I don't think there's a direct connection, but it's probably a matter of same causes, same effect. And I think it's the politics that have changed quite dramatically, at least in France and probably elsewhere, certainly in the UK. We used to have a very polarized system with the left and the right. And as you've said, Robert, some people think, well, serves them right and everybody's responsible for their action. And that tended to be the right wing. And then you had the left thinking, well, no, there's social issues, there's unemployment and things like that. And I don't see this anymore. at least not reflected in the politics and the population. Certainly, it's still there. But the politics no longer reflect this debate. You have the right, the left, and the center, because we've got a center or so-called center government at the moment. And they're all saying exactly the same. And no wonder people are wondering who they're going to vote next, because they're all saying the same, apart from the extremes. Who knows what they're going to come up with. But I don't know what that really means. What it means, though, is that what they're doing similarly is they're talking about sending everybody to prison and to being punitive. That's what they're all saying, the three groups, the three political groups. And at the same time, because they're sending a huge amount of people now in the criminal justice system, we've got zero tolerance policies as well, but they're different from the way they present elsewhere, I think. They're just petty crimes and petty crimes and petty crimes clogging the system. And of course, the fundings have gone down. So what do you do with all these new people in the system? Things have changed quite dramatically. And I think we need to sort of work our head around this. As far as the French public opinion, because we want to be comparative today, it's very difficult to know whether the French population is punitive or lenient. I mean, if you trust comparative studies, they will tell you that the French population is unbelievably lenient taken together. But at the same time, I think politicians think that the French population is very punitive because they keep telling them they're going to send everybody to jail. So what's, and they get elected. So what's going on? You know, I don't know. It used to be simpler. That's all I can say. And I think a lot of things have changed as well. I was just talking about the zero tolerance policies, but they focus on the petty crimes. In fact, it's not even petty crimes. It's nanoparticular crimes that enter the system now and that we spend a huge amount of time and energy and resources dealing with. Meanwhile, the serious crimes, well, we're not really, we're not really focusing on them as well as we should be doing. And you know what? I've been working quite a lot with psychologists over the last few years, and it's rubbed off on me quite a lot. And I've discovered this really interesting model called the need for closure. And what they're talking about is that there's a need in the population that varies. So sometimes you have high demand for certainty because the world is very threatening. And sometimes you've got sort of lower demand for closure, so certainty, because the world is more comfortable and we don't have wars in Ukraine and we don't have COVID and we don't have terrorist attacks. But that's precisely what's just happened. We've had 5 years of relentless terrorist attacks, and then we had COVID and the lockdown, and now we've got the war in Ukraine, and don't get me started on global warming. So no wonder the population needs certainty and therefore is looking for authoritarian responses and punitiveness. Whether they really want it, I don't know, but they want people to tell them. So politicians are definitely responding in this respect. So that's what I'm trying to, that's what I'm detecting, these changes, that is. Another thing I'd like to mention as well, I used to be a lawyer. I'm no longer really a lawyer. I've just dropped that a while ago, but what I've kept from being a lawyer is the focus on the processes. We're talking about punishment as if it was just substantive, like we're taking somebody and bam, and you're locked up or I'm doing something to you. But behind that, you've got a whole process, procedures lead into this, and the processes have changed dramatically as well. Because we're having all these cases being processed, we're having now rapid alternatives or diversion things, as we call them in England, on the cheap. And so that means that the first thing that's dropped is due process. And I think in terms of legitimacy, this does something to the population as well, because you're just being handled in a way like chop, 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 let's get things done, you know, in a sort of shabby office, you're going to get your hands slapped, or you're going to have to do 60 hours of this and 60 hours of that. So I think the way we think about punishment needs to include these massive changes, these tectonic plates, really, of changes. Very dystopian. Mike Nellis is listening. I know he's going to probably respond to that. And just going mad with the zero tolerance policies that just made us completely and utterly bonkers, pardon my French. So the last things maybe I wanted to comment on was were the first thing you the penal transfers sorry. So some of them fail and some of them are successful. So in France, the one that has failed is restorative justice. We had a 2014 act with Ministry of Justice who actually came from our West Indies, and she was very interested in sort of alternative justice, and she put it in the law. In France, we put everything in laws. We think it's going to change the world, but it didn't change the world. We've got sort of pockets of experiments here and there of RJ, but it hasn't really picked on. I mean, we've had like 1,000 years of state courts. How can you suddenly bring restorative justice back? Because it used to exist before the Middle Ages, you know. But conversely, community work that you mentioned, Rob, has been a massive success story in France, because I think it ticks pretty much every single box. The left loves it because you don't send people to jail, and you send them to work. And obviously the left believes in employment, and the right loves it because, well, they're going to have to wake up in the morning and take the bus, and they're going to be just like everybody else, and it's going to serve them rights, you know, and the center is in somewhere in the middle. So it always works, and politicians love that, and the population loves it, at least in France, love it. Maybe one last thing I'd like to mention as well. It's some very specific things that exist in France, and I'd like, maybe if there's time for this, that maybe some comparison would be interested. We've got a very Soviet system in France. I don't know if you guys perceive this, because you think about food and beautiful landscape and Paris or Paris, you know, but actually it's a very difficult country to live in. A huge amount of paperwork, managerism gone mad, but also we've got a really state-governed, centralized, monopolistic country, and you can't do anything in Marseille or in Brittany unless Paris says so. And we're here waiting until Paris says so, and then it trickles down, and then eventually, and it's really, really terrible. And the government is very it's like a monarchy. And prosecutors, for instance, have to comply with the orders from Paris. They're not independent. So it resembles countries that the French have criticized, such as Poland, for instance, you know, like in between governments. The justice system is certainly not independent from the state. But more positively, amongst the list of punishment goals that I might add to your list, Rob, and I'll end up with that, is education. I don't think that was in the list. And the French stance is education. It's a very strange word, but the idea is we're going to teach you how to think. So this permits probation, obviously. We sit you down in an office, and we're going to lecture you, and we're going to tell you how to think, and we're going to change a neo-Nazi into just a regular Democrat by teaching him 12 hours of, I don't know, the Holocaust or whatever. And that is enshrined in the literature. Rousseau and Hugo, they said both something things similar, but basically it goes like this: open a school and you'll close a prison. Well, we've got loads of schools. We still have a lot of prisons, and we're building new ones. So I don't think this works, but that's the culture for you anyway, very contrasted. So I think the cultural differences, they're not only between countries, they're within countries. That's what I was trying to show, basically. And I know it will resonate with a lot of other jurisdictions, where you can't compare Marseille and Paris, and Alsace is very German, and Brittany is very Celt, and et cetera, et cetera. So that's my end word, basically. It varies within. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Martin. It's just lots to think about there, but really very, very interesting. Thank you. So if I may move on and ask our other panel members for their international perspectives on this subject that we've been discussing. Selda?
Thank you, everyone, for such thought-provoking points. I just wanted to complicate a couple of the questions that have been put forward so far. In terms of both welfare and in terms of normative considerations as well, and the issue of morality and emotions, I find that really fascinating, Rob. So thank you for bringing that up. Okay, so where do I start? I don't even know where to start. It's a huge problem. But I will say that Australia, I'll start off with Australia. Australia has a really, well, I mean, compared to other nations and certainly compared to the United States, has a reasonably robust welfare system. And it is, it does actually, so when we're talking about populations being punitive and lenient, I think we need to complicate the situation even further and, oh, well, complicate that question even further and talk about towards whom we are lenient and punitive. So I think there's a huge disparity between certain groups within a given society towards whom we are extremely punitive and others towards whom I would suggest we are extremely lenient. And that's not going into the question of the role of punishment at this point in time. And I think that in terms of, well, I'll give you the Indigenous example in Australia. So Rob did allude to this. And I'm sorry, my thoughts are all over the place because I want to say so much about so many different issues, but I'll go back to the Indigenous population. In Australia, and I do, I am aware teaching in an American context now that the United States has one of the highest prison populations in the world, if not the highest prison population in the world. And within that criminal justice system, there's a vast overrepresentation of people of colour. In the Australian criminal justice system, and Rob alluded to these rates of incarceration as well. In the Australian criminal justice system, the rates of incarceration, while you were talking, Rob, I had a quick look at what the latest rates were. The Indigenous incarceration rate is 2,325 per 100,000 of the Indigenous population. So while we have a really robust welfare system compared to other nations, I mean, not as robust as, let's say, you know, Scandinavian nations, perhaps. What is going on with the Indigenous population? So this, I think, goes back to histories of colonisation and the dispossession of Indigenous Aboriginal Australians from their lands and basically the social disintegration and I suppose the genocide at the time that, you know, when, you know, the British invaded Indigenous lands, I suppose, you know, there was a complete social breakdown through social, through stolen generations, through, you know, mass killings because they weren't regarded as human. And, you know, they were, the lands were taken on the basis that there weren't humans inhabiting those lands. So because of that and the severe kind of social disintegration and socioeconomic disadvantage that has inflicted Australian Aboriginal groups, now there is this cycle. It is a legacy of colonisation. There is a cycle of incarceration, social disadvantage, and this revolving door and this these high rates of recidivism in the Australian system amongst Indigenous populations who have generations who are incarcerated. So that to me kind of, you know, complicates the question of is it around welfare states, which you've alluded to, Rob, and also Martine. And also it complicates the question of whether we are punitive or lenient as a society. I would suggest that we are punitive in Australia just by virtue of our stance on certain groups and our stance on immigration as well. So I feel that when there is a social norm that is somewhat exclusionary, it can kind of spill over into a punitive stance towards certain groups, though. So so it's not kind of it's not consistent. And I don't know, maybe I'll move on to the question of emotion as well and culture and normative consideration. So I guess it sort of comes back to, you know, whether we are punitive or lenient also comes back to this idea of justice. What do we think justice is? So what are our conceptions of justice? And it's a really interesting question because it's such an amorphous concept. And actually, I asked my Hunter College students here in New York what they thought justice was. And some of them actually talked about it in terms of the criminal justice system and said justice is when we show symbolically society that we do not condone certain behaviours, which is very much based on a concept of consistent norms across all of society. So a social consensus in that kind of Durkheimian sense of social solidarity and consensus. But others actually said justice is about, and here we come back to the welfare system, justice is about social equality. So social equality and leveling the playing field, and then, you know, it's really got nothing to do with the criminal justice system. And then others talked about emotion. So others talked about justice in terms of emotion and drawing that back to morality, which is kind of a concept of morals being attached to how we react emotionally, which comes from David Hume. So I don't know where I'm going with that, but I feel that towards the populations that we feel an affinity or we feel we are culturally sort of consistent with certain populations, then we tend to feel, and I'm not saying we as in this group or me personally, there is a pattern of more empathy towards certain groups that are more like us, and that sort of informs our conceptions of justice towards certain groups and our morality and our normative idea and our cultural kind of norms. And that's, yeah, and towards outsiders, perhaps we feel less of an affinity. And it's a very simplistic view, but it is a pattern that I have seen in terms of narratives around punishment and punitiveness and leniency as well, and also my own research and teaching as well, just speaking to students even. Okay, I hope that made sense. I feel like I rambled a little bit, but there was so much going on that I wanted to get out. Thank you so much.
Not at all. Thank you, Sardar, and thank you for raising the complicated issue, as you say, around punishment and leniency and to whom, basically, which I think is really, really sort of great point for us to think about. Okay, can I ask someone else? I'm going to point to John to give us your perspective.
Hello, Rose. Can you see me now?
I can't. I can hear you, but I can't. We can't see you. But
I have one more go to fiddle with this.
Okay.
Let me try that. Nope. Right. I'm in the dark. I'm in the dark.
You warned us it was misty, John.
Thanks, Robbie. It is very misty. I'm sitting here with a beautiful view across across the Solway Firth and the River Net. It's we're on a new campus, and it's really beautiful.
Well, we are missing out then, aren't we? Gosh, yes.
I've lived in Scotland all my life, and it's only recently in more recent years that I've begun to take a comparative approach to things, and I've learned so much from thinking about probation in other countries. And I was thinking, as Zelda was speaking, about a diagram. I think it's in the book Offender Supervision in Europe, and it's of an iceberg, and it says that, you know, what seems to look the same on the surface, the visible things about probation, about supervision and about probation, are being propelled underneath the surface by very different cultural understandings. And I think Fergus McNeill says the important thing is it's how that experience is lived by practitioners and end service users. Despite having lived in Scotland all my life, it is a bit of a mystery to me, Scotland, because we're not England. We joined up to form the United Kingdom, I think, in 1707. And the terms of the unification of the countries was that Scotland would keep its own education system, it would keep its own religious system, and it would keep its own legal system. So we've always been free to do something a bit different from England. And the community sentence of probation in the 1940s and 50s was almost dying out as a disposal for adult offenders. And we formed a committee to look into that. And the committee looked into what we could do with young people who offend. It was post-war. There was a feeling that children were getting out of control. And what we created was a separate service for children in the justice system, the criminal justice system, that had this motto that we would look at children according to their needs and not according to their deeds. And that was really important. And we still have that system of children's hearings where members of the local communities decide whether children should be under supervision or whether they should be at home with their parents and under supervision, or they should be removed from their parents. So we have this in our justice system of our probation staff, at least. We have this strong tradition of welfareism. So we like to think that we're kind and sympathetic, and we're one of the few countries where probation staff are still located in local authorities. We don't have a separate probation service. So I'm involved on a day-to-day basis in training social workers who may work in the children and families system, who may work in the adult system, or who may work in the criminal justice system. And we're all signed up to a code of practice that emphasises care. So that's where I come from as a practitioner. Is that where everyone else in my country comes from, I wonder? I'm thinking about this huge, bizarre thing at the centre of Scottish justice practice. We have this tradition of welfareism and this motto that's ingrained in me, and I think in many other people in Scotland, about considering people according to their needs rather than their deeds. But yet we have a very high imprisonment rate. Martine was saying France 119 per 100,000. I think we're about 142, 145, and we just refuse to come down. I wonder about the difference between Scotland and France, Martine, in that we have quite a lot of older people in prison now because we have no concept of prescription that you have in France, and that people are chased up many years later for sexual offences. So we've got a lot of older people in prison, and I think that we can be very, very punitive towards certain types of offences, as Rob was saying. I'm thinking about to show that kind of contrast. I'm remembering we're about to have a change of Prime Minister, First Minister in Scotland. Nicola Sturgeon, no relation to me, has been our Prime Minister for a long time. And I'm remembering something that she said, which I think shows this approach that we've been trying to establish. She was interviewed in 2018 by a journalist in the Guardian, a journalist called Rachel Kushner, and they got onto the subject of her views on prisons and punishments. And one of the things she said was that, you know, prison is the right and appropriate place for people who pose a risk to other people. She was very clear on that. But she also went on to say, and I'm going to paraphrase and not get the wording right, she said that whilst that's the right place for some people, there are other people who are victims of other ills in society, and prison is not the right place for them. So this is our most senior politician saying that she's very unhappy with the with certain groups of people ending up in our justice system. So is that replicated within our wider culture in Scotland? We have, at the same time, like a lot of other countries, we have put more people in prison. We've put more people in prison for longer. But at the same time, we have expanded the whole probation estate, if you like. More people are being supervised in the community than ever before. And I think that's common. That's this the notion of net widening that we know very well. In Scotland, we have resisted populism, I think, as a response. I kind of jump from one subject to the other there. We've resisted populism, and I think that's because since we formed the Scottish Parliament in 1999, we've had a series of minority governments, so that requires compromise. So in relation to Martin's bureaucracy, I think there's been a lot of negotiation and things that have been going on. And I think we have a judicial system or a sentencing practice that's not quite completely insane, and it doesn't go from one extreme to the other. I think about the populism that was around. I can think of a couple of incidences of that where I remember the Scottish Secretary in about 19, goodness, when was he around? Michael Forsyth. I remember he was the Scottish Secretary. So this was before the Scottish Parliament. And I remember his brother was on community service doing unpaid work. And he said it was very, very easy. And his brother reacted to that by following a populist cry for more effective, more visible punishment. And then I think we joined in with England about criminalising young people with antisocial behaviour orders. But I think these kind of things have moved into the past. So what do the public in Scotland think? Because I'm thinking about Rob's point about anger and emotion in sentencing. We did a telephone survey. We, Scotland, did a telephone survey. They phoned 1,000 adults in 2018, and they had a 15-minute phone call about offending and about sentencing. And what they found was that people had quite strong views on the criminal justice system and on sentencing. But there was not a clear understanding of the criminal justice process, and where that understanding of the criminal justice process was at its weakest, confidence in the punishment and the justice system was at its lower. And where it was highest, they found that people were more tolerant. So in asking people about their views on courts and sentences and punishment, where people had higher levels of education, there was greater deals of satisfaction and a shared purpose in the justice system. So which kind of people do we punish more? What kind of people had the most outrage? And of course, that really was sexual offenders with in this survey, I think I remember it was young people who were more intolerant of sexual offending and wanted harsher sentences, where older people who wanted harsh punishment for other things were a little bit more lenient on the sexual offending. So I think our culture is I think it's a mix. I think lower levels of education are crying out for more punishment, and higher levels of education are calling out for more leniency because they have confidence in the system. One thing that I will mention is that one of the purposes of this research was to pave the way for sentencing guidelines in relation to certain categories of offending, road traffic, deaths, young people, and I think there was it was financial crime as well, it was in there. There's four categories. And in 26th of January 2022, the Scottish Sentencing Council, who are a body appointed by the government to set guidelines for sentencing, they did an inquiry on what we should do in sentencing young people. What should be our approach? And given our welfare background was highly influential in that. And what they came out with was that the 18 to 25-year-olds should be sentenced in the adult courts, should be sentenced with different considerations in mind. And that's the consideration of emotional maturity. It was argued and they accepted that the brain is still developing, and that until you're 25, you are more likely to be impulsive, and you're more likely not to think through very clearly the consequences of your action. So a lack of maturity maybe is less to blame, but the author of the facts is still responsible. We've been thinking a lot about trauma in our country, and we've been recognising in a small study in the prison for young people in Scotland that a lot of people have suffered trauma. They've been around violence, they've been around the death. So the court has to consider, in passing sentence on someone under 20, 25 and under, the maturity at the time of the offence. And the other thing it says in the guidelines for young people is that amongst all of the other objectives in sentencing, and Rob, I was checking through your purposes of sentencing, they're the same in Scotland as they are in England, that rehabilitation is the primary consideration, because people in our justice system have young people have been in care, they've suffered trauma, they've experienced a lot of personal loss through death. So it's like any other country, Ros, Scotland's a very nuanced position. A lot of people locked up in prison for a long time. The public seem to be quite sympathetic to certain types of offence, asking for leniency and punitiveness on different kinds of offences and different age groups. And the survey also found that amongst the public, young people and old people, educated people, less educated people, had different expectations, different level of satisfaction.
Oh, thank you for that. That is, again, it's just putting more of not a complication, but actually looking at how complicated it is to decipher whether or not the culture is punitive or lenient. That's really, really interesting. Thank you, John. And I'm going to quickly move to Michael for your response to the conversations that we've been having so far.
Well, thank you. As several have mentioned, when you talk about the United States leading the world and the numbers of incarceration, it's clear that we are obviously very punitive, and just in those numbers alone. But when I hear the conversation, I want to, for my purposes, stick more to the role of punishment in the lens that is looked through here. A couple of things. It's very polarizing, even here in the United States. You have two extremes. And you have some that are in the middle. But what I find even more interesting is not just among the states, but even within our own states, we have that same polarization. And what really drives the views on punishment is what the community expects and what the community will tolerate. And that is determined through who you elect into those offices, whether it be a district attorney or whether it be a judge. So you can be in one county right next door. And an example is you can have a judge sentence someone to prison and make the comment, you made a mistake when you took a left and crossed the river into our county. Because for the same thing in the next county, it would probably be probation. So you have that division at a macro level and also a micro level. I think everyone agrees that they want to serve to prevent crime. That's what they're looking at. I think the question is, how do they do that? The purpose, as Rob indicated, I think aligns right with us in the U.S. Do we incapacitate? Are these individuals that we have said, you're no longer welcome in society? You have done so much harm, or you show no desire or even no opportunity to reform. So therefore, we will incapacitate you. Or do we rehabilitate? Do we recognize mistakes were made? They take responsibility, and therefore they are a part of society, and we help them become even better, more productive citizens. Sometimes it is about reparation and restitution. And then sometimes it's just to get a pound of flesh and punish. I'm not so sure that we stop enough to ask why are we sentencing? What is our goal? What's the outcome we are desiring? I think everybody agrees with accountability in the United States. And there's a high level of accountability. You've got an agreement to abide by the law. If you don't abide by the law, there will be consequences associated with that. And so that's driven by accountability. One thing I will say here, and the question was posed about the media, I think punishment is often driven strictly by emotion. Despite all the research we have, it is still often driven by emotion. And you can share research and somebody go, yeah, I get that, but they deserve this. And that is very, very challenging. Punishment for the sake of punishment is easy. That really is simple. And I think that's why there is a high level of punishment, because oftentimes people get frustrated because they don't know what else to do. So they yield to the easy way of addressing the problem. One thing that I think the United States has to continue to improve upon, we do have, even the polarization, we still seem to operate in a system that one size fits all. And you talk about the mandatory, the minimums, but I think the goal that we're moving towards is a one size fits one. Sentencing is tailored to the individual's needs and risk, because we truly don't know if we get a better outcome if we send someone to prison for a year or we send someone to prison for 10 years. We just simply don't know. A lot of times, we'll look and people say, well, they didn't go to prison because they took responsibility for their action. And a lot of times when individuals want to go to a trial, for instance, people wonder, oh, well, they're getting punished for exercising their constitutional right. And it's like, no, they are being punished because they are not taking responsibility and accepting that what they did was wrong. Whereas folks that may plead guilty are saying, I recognize I did wrong, I'm taking responsibility. So the punishment is less. I think the what and the reasoning behind it, and the desired outcome, we all probably want the same thing. But I think the challenge is the how. How do we go about doing that? And that has always certainly been a challenge. And in the United States, it's interesting that we sentence and we have very little interaction about those that are on the receiving end of the sentence and engaging them in, you know, was this helpful? Was it hurtful? And they're the receivers of the punishment being doled out. And sometimes they're not even part of the conversation. It is a very complicated issue. And it seemed different through so many different lenses. And I would agree there's certainly in the United States a disproportionate number of African Americans, not just in the prison system, but also under community supervision. And it's also disproportionate perhaps in regards to the length of their sentence or the fact of whether or not they can earn their way off of supervision.
Thank you. I think I haven't seen any questions in the chat. Does anyone have any quick questions that we could put to the panel? Well, while people are thinking about it, well, what's your thoughts about people taking responsibility, you know, showing remorse, and how will that impact on sentencing? And sentencers, because this is something that we talked about. We talk about in terms of individuals showing remorse and taking responsibility for their behaviour. What are your thoughts around that?
Can I start off on that just quickly? The first thing is that I'd like to say is that sometimes how people plead is a very tactical matter, and advice they may take advice from their legal representatives. The second thing is, isn't remorse, I think, is an incredibly interesting topic, because it's often said, you know, you have shown no remorse, but some people don't know how to show remorse. Some people have remorse, but have no idea how to express that. How do you do that in the setting of a court? Because there is no opportunity in a court often for the defendant to say anything. Their remorse is expressed through the over-practiced formulae of their defending lawyers. Is remorse a good predictor of future behavior? I think probably it isn't, but it matters hugely, does it not, in terms of how we feel about people's conduct. So remorse is a great topic, Roz, and you could keep us here for another few hours on that one alone.
I'm sure. And I suspect it's different in different jurisdictions, different cultures. So there's so many different layers around remorse, shame, and taking responsibility. Sorry.
If I may, I think there's a big difference between responsibility and remorse. You can take responsibility for your action, but you may not be remorseful about it. And so I think those are really handled at two different levels. I know, first of all, I'm not so sure you can be remorseful without first taking responsibility. But that's just the way I see those two dynamics.
Thank you. Mike, I can see you've put your camera on. Did you want to contribute, Mike?
Thank you. Well, I was actually going to make exactly the same point that Michael just made, that responsibility and remorse may not actually go together. And what was sticking in my mind about that is that we have a very famous example in Scotland of a man called Jimmy Boyle, who was once a very violent man who was successfully rehabilitated. This all took place a long time ago, but he famously took responsibility to change himself, but he pointedly refused to express any remorse, because in the violent culture in which he grew up, with gangsters fighting gangsters, he didn't feel that there was any point in expressing remorse. but he did, when he had the opportunity, take the responsibility to change his life, right? So I agree with Michael that remorse and responsibility don't necessarily tie together. And I mean, I think I might disagree with you, Michael, that in order to express remorse, that implies you've taken responsibility, because the point that Rob just made, that remorse is not an indicator of reduced recidivism, suggests to me that you can express remorse, and it may be very genuine remorse, not just situational or context bound remorse, but you still don't have the capital, the resources within your life to take responsibility. So you link them together, and they're both important. And in some instances, they may well go together. But I can actually think at the moment of more examples where they don't necessarily.
Thank you, Mike. Martin, sorry, I just noticed you've got your hand up. Would you like to come in?
Yeah, yes, thank you very much. I really like this conversation. It's getting complicated as well, like everything else we've talked about. But in France, we have a sort of intermediary court. It's called a juge de l'application des peines. So it's like, it's the judge in charge of probation, overseeing probation. So community sentences, but also release measures. So conditional release, parole, as it's called in the United States. We've got a large variety of measures, but it doesn't really matter at this point. So this judge is like a sort of reentry judge, as it is called in the States. And so I've seen hundreds and hundreds of hearings with Jap, and there's always this moment, this sort of aha magic moment, where the judge wants to know what the, so it's called, what's your, in French we say position, it doesn't sound well in English, but what's your viewpoint on what you've done, you know, what do you have to say about this? And what they're expecting is the person to say, well, actually I did it. I mean, we're not even talking about remorse or anything like that. In fact, I suspect that French people would find it a bit suspicious if somebody was just like, oh, I'm ever so sorry, you know, oh, I know I've done wrong. French people would say, he's just doing it a bit, just too much. Just we don't need all of that thing, you know, but at least say, I've done it. A lot of offenders won't even recognize that.
Yeah.
But it's not enough though, because sometimes, depending on the tone, you know, sometimes they say, well, okay. Or, you know, maybe, you know. But anyways, when they say that, then the judge is not happy, and they say, well, do you confess to, or are you unhappy that because you've done it? Or is it because you've been caught? Or is it because your parents are unhappy? Or is it about the victim? Or, you know, and it's just runs around in circle, basically.
You see that, yeah.
You know, it's never the right thing. But the other thing I wanted to say as well, that during the same kind of discussion, the other thing that our judges are interested in, and this particular category of judge, they're focused on the future. The sentencing judge is focused on retribution. But because we've got this other judge is concerned about the future. So then comes the next question, what's your plan for the future? And then it becomes interesting, you know. Yeah.
Thank you. So I'm going to just bring in John and then Zelda, and then we're going to have to, I think we're running out of time. So John.
Yeah, I've really not got too much to say on this. I think Rob made the point that I was going to make about when you're in court and taking responsibility, putting your hand up, making an early guilty plea. Is it taking responsibility, or is it a strategic maneuver to get a reduced sentence, or convey yourself in some other kind of light? By using theatrical devices. I've been referring to the attitudes to courts and sentencing report from 2019, and it was interesting in there that the public interviewed 1,000 people. There was a bit of a trend there to say that whether someone puts in an early guilty plea or puts their hand up quickly, they really didn't have much sympathy with that, and they didn't really feel that that should be taken into account. And that was a very strong view, one of the strongest views in that whole survey. I'm really not sure what that's about. Maybe people are just rather cynical and see it as a gesture of manipulation.
Thank you. And Zelda, I've got one more question as well before we go back to Rob.
Yeah, so this is going back another step to jury trials and the finding of guilt acquittal. So I just wanted to go back to the question of remorse and how much that depends on this normative idea of a sympathetic witness. So, and I find we've just talked about battered woman syndrome and women that murder their husbands after years of domestic violence, right? And it's, you know, a particular pathology that's described. But there was a really interesting case in the United States that Michael might know about one particular woman. I can't recall her name. I think it was, anyway, I can't recall her name at this point in time. But the judge famously said, if he had some normative expectations, gendered expectations about how she should be behaving after murdering her husband. And notably, he said, if it were my wife on the stand, she would be absolutely beside herself. But Nancy, that's it. Nancy Seaman, you know who I'm talking about, don't you, Michael? Maybe you do. But Nancy Seaman, she was not a sympathetic witness. She did not cry. She did not show emotion. So we're coming back to emotion. And there are certain normative expectations around emotion that can be both cultural, as Martine pointed out, but also gendered, highly gendered,
yeah,
particular,
yeah,
cultural framework.
Yeah, yep, definitely. Oh, thank you for that. And there was a question about restorative justice that I think, Marty, you've answered. Somebody asked about why it did not work, and you've responded to that in the chat, I think.
I think there's another question. Sorry to interrupt, Ros. There was one that said, I think it was John Scott, I'm interested to ask if popular opinion is driven by the media or responds to it. Interesting question. No clue. Oh. Bit of both. We call it a Normand response. It's both. It goes both ways.
Brilliant. So I have got one more question. Any more questions? No more questions are coming up in the chat. But what about professionals in the system? How do you think they'd have a voice around this punishment debate? I'm posing now.
Could you ask that again, please?
Yeah, please.
So,
sorry.
How can professionals in the system have a voice in the punishment debate?
My feeling is that you base it on research and data, and let that tell your story and paint the picture. And that to me is one of the easiest ways, because they may not listen to the individual, but they will perhaps listen to research and the story that's been told through the data that's presented before.
Thank you. Rob, did you want to come in or
no? Yeah, I don't know whether you want me to wrap this up, Ros.
I will do. I just to say, Sybil made a really nice, good point about Shamima Begum in the chat around, you know, I think it, as Zelda was talking about, a gendered response to the situation, and that might not have engendered empathy towards. So it's a really, really good point. So,
yeah, but you're right, Ros, and it bears out, does it not, Zelda's point about the differences in punitiveness.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Brilliant. So I think it's time now. Thank you, everyone that contributed and asked questions. Thank you also to the panel for a really, really interesting conversation. But I'd like now, Rob, to give your final thoughts.
Yeah, and I will not be long, because in the chat, Rob Watson has reminded us that there is an opportunity on the 29th of March for us to take this further. So I'm not going to say much at all. Just 2 points, really. One of them is to develop something that Michael said. We don't talk enough to people who have been or are still subject to punishment. If we talk about punishment without regard to what it means to them, as well as to the people who are putting punishments into effect, then we have an incomplete understanding. And people who have researched this have sometimes discovered that what we think is hurtful is not quite what is so hurtful. There are other things, particularly the sense of shame, degradation, the lack of worth, and so forth, that it's those things are in some ways more painful than, for example, I don't know, digging a ditch in rotten weather. Those, it's those kinds of things, and we can make a difference to that. So yes, if we want to know what punishment is, then we need to talk to those who are being punished as well as to those who respond, penal practitioners. And I think that I just like to leave you with the words of David Garland. David Garland spoke about the tragedy of punishment, and that's something I think that is chastening and worth reflecting for all of us. And for David Garland, the tragedy is that punishment is politically indispensable, and I would add emotionally indispensable, but can in fact achieve none of the objectives that it sets for itself. So globally, you know, we've said all these things that it can do, it can protect the public and so on and so on. It can't, or very poorly, very inadequately. And in some cases, it makes things worse, doesn't it? Imprisonment, on which so many countries depend, blocks resistance, makes things worse, does nothing really, except perhaps to satisfy certain emotions, particularly perhaps anger and fear and disgust. So those would be my final words, that punishment is tragic, but maybe inescapable. Thank you, Ros, for sharing. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Rob, for your contribution. And thank you to the other panel members, Martine, Michael, Zelda, and John, for your contributions. And as it has said in the chat, do come and join us at the Open Forum in 14 days' time, where we can continue this really interesting conversation. And you can find details of this forum on the INCJ website. Thank you very much and have a pleasant evening.
You have been listening to the INCJ podcast, Conversations about International Criminal Justice. To find out more, go to our website at criminaljusticenetwork.net or follow us on Twitter at INTCJ Network.